Welcome to Northern Soundings Alaska in Conversation. I'm your host, Robert Hannon. Marine scientist, zoologist, and author Ron Smith reviews some of the high points and low points of his research.
That boat would roll side to side, and they had an inclinometer there that when we caught the edge of the hurricane on the first trip, you could see that inclinometer go to 45 degrees to the other side. It was interesting.
I hope you'll join me for the last of a special summer series. This summer on Northern Soundings, I've run a series of recorded conversations with retired University of Alaska Fairbanks scholars, researchers, and leaders. Our discussions took place live Monday nights at the Murray Auditorium on the UAF campus in a series called Down Memory Lane. The series is hosted by UAF Summer Sessions, and my thanks to it for collaborating with me. My guest this week, Ronald L. Smith, is a man born in Marshall, Texas, who thought he'd become a desert researcher, but instead became a marine scientist. Ron moved to Alaska from Florida almost immediately after receiving his PhD, and here he not only did extensive marine work, but also became a popular University of Alaska Fairbanks lecturer on a wide range of subjects. Ron is also the author of three very different books, a No Fooling Around textbook on Interior and Northern Alaska Natural History, a novel that tackles in part the plight of the Navajo and the internment of Japanese Americans, and also a whimsically written and illustrated book on how not to die hunting in Alaska. Ron calls his novel, Undeserved Punishment, partially autobiographical, so I began our discussion by asking him about that work.
Well, it wrestled with my upbringing, as most people do, off and on for most of my life. Everybody has something in their childhood that kind of serves as a turning point or a stimulus for development or growth, and those formative years, grades 2 through 6, on the Navajo Reservation or around the Navajo Reservation were very instructive in terms of the natural history that Dad took us to every weekend. We'd go on field trips, see things, go to Navajo Sings, go to Monument Valley. We did all kinds of interesting things in typically very high places. My dad loved heights. I think one of the themes that runs through the novel is our continual arrival at very high places. My dad just seemed to thrive on that kind of stuff. So he was very interested in cultures, in the natural world, in geography, and he took us to a lot of places. So that was an informative aspect of my life. Meeting Navajos and learning about their lifestyle was a part of the playground experience. And it came to me as something of a shock when my first 2 years was not in actual classrooms with Navajo students, but I could see by the way other students and other white men approached Navajos and their culture. I was very shocked to find that they were not treated with the respect I felt I was taught to treat everyone with.
Sure.
And then in some summers that my brother and I spent with my grandparents in a little native village called Loop, Arizona, which figures in the novel, my brother and I stumbled across the remnants of a Japanese internment camp, which the one at Loop was the one for troublemakers. It was an isolation camp for Japanese American internees that had been sent to other places but had the audacity to speak up and say they were being mistreated as American citizens. And so when we finally asked my grandfather, what is this place here? He started to describe what it was, and even he, a very stern man, broke down
at
the injustice.
You tackle, it's a rich stew of ideas that you tackle in your novel, and social justice is a recurring theme there. Not only Japanese Americans and the Navajo, but that whole issue of a missionary grandfather and that dynamic at play.
Yeah, my grandparents were pretty stern. I actually, in that portion of my life, well, for all the time I knew my grandmother, I never felt she loved anyone, even my grandfather. And I've puzzled over why my grandfather put up with that kind of attitude in her.
So the novel was a way of coming to terms with that and working. Was that a cathartic experience for you, Ron?
Well, yeah, I'd say working through a whole bunch of different aspects of my childhood, one of which was a set of family rules that were totally ridiculous and took the form of do as I say, don't do as I do. Mm-hmm. Adults were exempt from these family rules, even though the children were to adhere to them and be punished if they did not. So that was an aspect of justice as well.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Your dad seemed to have loved the natural world. And is that where you got your drive to study biology?
Absolutely. So his degree in college was actually in physics, but he went far beyond physics in terms of his interest in science. So he would take us a variety of places when I was growing up to the top of a forest fire watchtower, just see a different view of the landscape to both rims of the Grand Canyon, Canyon de Chelly. We walked down the trails in Walnut Canyon and actually parked ourselves in these old declivities that were the erosional result of different strata of limestone on the hills. So the very, very soft, easily eroded part were where the cliff dwellers built their dwellings.
It must have been fun.
Oh, it was.
Yeah.
Fun and sometimes terrifying. If any of you have ever been to Montezuma Castle in central Arizona, you know that it perches 70 feet up a sheer cliff from the floor of the valley. And we were among the last that were able to actually climb the old ladders up into Montezuma's castle. And of course, Dad insisted that we do that. We were among the last to actually climb the trail up to the top of Sunset Crater, which was this cinder cone just east of Flagstaff. Can't do it anymore because the human traffic was just destroying the crater.
So you went to Occidental College in LA.
Right.
Why did you choose that?
You know, my parents raised us as Presbyterians. Occidental College was originally founded by the Presbyterian Church. So that was in Mom and Dad's head. It wasn't necessarily in mine. It was a private college and it was pretty expensive. And I said, you know, this is gonna be really costly. They said, no, you should apply. And I did, and I applied to a number of other colleges in that area. It turns out they offered me two scholarships to go there. One was an academic-based scholarship because I was valedictorian of my high school class. And the other was a track scholarship. I'd run track, and I know a couple of people in the audience that also ran hurdles in high school, Dale and Ken. We talked about this on this infamous goat hunt in my How Not to Die hunting book. Discovered that we'd all run high hurdles in high school. Luckily, I'd run one of the fastest times in the state of California in the high hurdles when I was a senior. So they gave me this scholarship, one for academic and one for track. And Occidental College at the time had one of the best track programs in the United States of America.
No kidding.
Yeah, it's 2,000 students in this college, and we would take on USC and usually beat them in track.
Wow.
Yeah, it was just an astounding place for attracting track talent.
Yeah.
And in fact, some of my running mates in college went on to the 64 Olympics.
Fascinating.
I didn't. Because I found running track and beating the books and making the grades were mutually exclusive for me. Mm. I just wasn't talented enough.
Yeah.
In either academics or track.
Oh, right. Yeah, sure. For you, the books predominated, and when did biology bite you as a major?
Well, I enrolled at Occidental as a chemistry major, and to this day I can't remember why. Because you can't do chemistry walking around outdoors, which is what I love to do. And to be a chemistry major required a fair amount of mathematics. So I took this pretty advanced introductory chemistry course my freshman year and took calculus, took 18 credits the first
Holy
semester.
Holy smokes.
And so I aced the chemistry and got a D in calculus. Then in a at the end of a track meet in my freshman year, my appendix kind of blew up. And so there were some issues that kind of dictated that track wasn't going to work.
Sure.
And of course, one of the reasons I didn't continue in chemistry was this physical chemistry course looming in the future that required calculus just to do the homework. And I thought, wait a minute. I really like biology. Why don't, Why don't I do this thing I really love?
Yeah. Well, and you went on into marine science. For a guy from Marshall, Texas, which is inland, why marine science?
I always thought I was going to be a desert biologist.
Yeah,
I really did,
guess
because
so.
I grew up on the desert.
Sure.
That was the best. But when I got to Occidental, my faculty advisor taught the vertebrate biology class, and he was a fish biologist. That was his thing. Mm-hmm. He also taught comparative vertebrate anatomy, which was the killer course for pre-meds. And I was so naive about college that I thought it was a fabulous course. We started with 54 students in the semester, ended with 21. The pre-meds were dropping out because if they couldn't get at least a B, you know, it was going to cripple their chances for medical school. But I just thought, wow, this is really interesting. all these different anatomical structures evolving through these vertebrate groups. Anyway, long story short, when I was a senior, we'd been taking field trips to collect fish, beach seines and stuff like that. And he said, Ron, you ought to really apply to University of Miami. They have a good fish program there. I said, well, that's one of the places I'll apply then. And the answer to your question, why marine science, why Miami, it all came down to money. They offered me a 3-year full-ride fellowship to go to graduate school there. And my folks had worked so hard, and I had worked so hard to get me through those 4 years, that the appeal of having a full-ride fellowship was just too much to resist.
Of course, sure.
Yeah, so.
It sounds like this biologist at Occidental was something of a mentor for you.
Yes.
Was he the mentor that really sort of stirred you?
I think so. His name was John Stevens, and he was excellent in the classroom. He was personable. He was just an ideal role model.
Yeah. And did you like the faculty when you went over to Miami, Coral Gables?
I did, yeah. There were some fabulous people there working in basically all the disciplines of oceanography. There were systematic zoologists working in marine invertebrates and fish, marine fish. There were chemical oceanographers, geological, physical, general oceanographers, meteorologists. It was really
top notch. Yeah,
absolutely.
Yeah, encouraging. So did you go out at sea a lot for your work, for your schoolwork?
That was a requirement for a graduate student.
So how did a landlubber, originally a desert guy, handle that?
Well, if the weather was nice, I could handle it fine. My first oceanographic cruise was supposed to take us past the Bahamas through the Gulf Stream out into that region sometimes popularly referred to as the Bermuda Triangle. You have to know that this research vessel, the RV Gerda, G-E-R-D-A, was a converted Norwegian trawler, and it had a round bottom, no keel. In storms, that boat would roll side to side, and they had an inclinometer there that when we caught the edge of the hurricane on the first trip, you could see that inclinometer go to 45 degrees, 45 degrees to the other side. It was interesting.
I think so.
I could recommend it for weight loss.
Really sort of purge yourself on that.
Absolutely.
Voyage, right?
Yeah. That's where I learned that if you're going to be seasick, drink lemonade. Doesn't mean you can keep it down, but it tastes the same coming up.
That's a health tip. You don't need to go to healthy living tomorrow.
This is Northern Soundings, and I'm talking with marine scientist and author Ron Smith. When we return from the break, going north. Welcome back. This is Northern Soundings. This summer I'm airing recorded discussions I hosted as part of UAF Summer Sessions event called Down Memory Lane. This week I'm speaking with marine scientist and author Ron Smith. Let's get back to the conversation.
As soon as you got your PhD, you came up to Fairbanks.
Right.
And so again, what directed you northwards?
Follow the money. Yeah, I was offered a job. It was a little more complicated than that. Before I actually finished my PhD, I was invited up for an interview with the Institute of Marine Science. The director back then, Don Hood, really wonderful man, was very instrumental in fostering marine research at this institution. He wanted to get more of a fish presence in the institute. He kept calling me a fishery biologist, and I kept correcting him. But I didn't correct him too sternly because he had it in mind he wanted a fishery biologist, and if that's what he wanted, then that's what I would try to be.
Sure.
So I flew up from Miami in January. I had a fleece jacket. Well, it was like a fleece jacket, and of course it was 37 below when I stepped off the airplane.
Yikes.
That, by the way, that was back in 1967 when there were no jetways. You know, they rolled the ladder up to the plane on the tarmac and you hoofed it on in. But Don was there with somebody else's parka to let me wear.
Phew.
Yeah, so I did the interview, met a lot of the faculty in both the Institute of Marine Science and the Department of Biology. And then they decided they didn't actually have enough money to hire a fishery or fish biologist. Mm. But I went to a ichthyological conference, that's fish, in Ann Arbor, Michigan that spring and gave a scientific paper. And the then head of the biology department, Jim Morrow, was there. I'd met him up here, saw him again, asked him if there might be any positions opening up in biology up here. He said, well, if you were a physiologist, you know, we'd have an opening. I said, why, yes, I am.
Funny you should mention that.
Because that happened to be the thrust of my work on fish up to that point. So he said, well, I'll tell our dean about your qualifications. And I happen to have a curriculum vitae that I handed him. You don't go anywhere without one of these, you know, if you're looking for a job. And just before I defended my dissertation, I got a call from Bryna Kessel, who was the dean of the College of Fisheries, Wildlife, and Biology. She was actually the person that did the hiring. She did a telephone interview, offered me the job. My fish professor at Miami had said, you know, Ron, we'd like to keep you here and put you in a fish biologist position on the main campus. And his idea was he would teach the fish systematics course, which is who's related to whom in the fish world, and I would teach the biology. But I told him, you know, this monotony of the Florida landscape is killing my soul. It was so flat. Everywhere you looked, hibiscus were in bloom all the time. And sometimes just to escape the noise of the city, my wife and I would drive down to the Everglades, and the only thing you could hear was the buzz of mosquitoes. But that was better than being in Miami. So there was no choice.
Tell me about the department when you got here, Ron. Who was here, and what are some of your first impressions?
My first impression on driving into Fairbanks, and my dad was always one, he drove up with me. He was always one to coin a phrase. He said, well, we drove north into autumn, because we left California in the sweltering heat, and by the time we were pulling into Fairbanks, this was mid-August, and some of the aspen leaves were turning yellow. Well, that right there, compared to what we see today, tells you something about climate change. So that was my first impression.
And this is 68, right?
Yeah, 1968. Yep. My impression of the campus was it was still under construction. You know, the Fine Arts Building was going up. Greening was being completed. And then Wood Center was under construction. Wasn't called Wood Center then. And the faculty who were present, Jim Morrow had stepped down as department head, but he was still here as an ichthyologist. Jerry Swartz was then department head. And I walked in expecting to teach introductory biology right off, like you've got 2 weeks to prepare introductory biology. But Jerry said, walked in and said, and I'll thank him. I thanked him then, and I'll thank you again now, Jerry, for this. He said, listen, I'm scheduled to teach invertebrate zoology, and you're scheduled to teach introductory biology. Would you be interested in switching? You bet. Because I'd had, you know, graduate level courses in invertebrate zoology and fish too. And that gave me an opportunity to teach a course that I'm very, very glad that I did, because it was a wonderful thing. We ordered all these live specimens from the California coast that were sometimes collected in the field, sometimes maintained in the laboratory. We would get them here, put them in marine tanks, and students could actually see these critters alive. And it was just, it was the best course. It was just a fun way to start my academic career in teaching. So thank you, Jerry.
A couple of things before we get to your teaching, because you teach a wide range of subject matters. I do want to ask the difference between oceanography and marine science. It seems like they kind of overlap, do they?
Well, in my mind, there's not much difference. Oceanography encompasses the study of the oceans. The Russians, Soviets at that time, referred to it as oceanology. There must be some fine distinction you could draw between oceanology, oceanography, and marine science. I haven't worried too much about that, not since I passed the PhD qualifying exams.
Your degrees were in marine science, but you're known as a zoology professor. And zoology, zoology, let's call the whole thing off. How does that work?
Well, I say zoology because if somebody says zoology, they think you're in a zoo.
Gotcha.
Or studying a zoo. So I just prefer to say zoology.
But it's interesting reading your scientific publications. You were publishing almost immediately when you were here. What are some of the research projects that you worked on that stand out for you?
Well, the very, very first research grant I got was to study winter adaptation of marine fish in shallow water. And of course, the place I chose to do that was Eisenbeck Lagoon, which is tip of the Alaska Peninsula. It's on the Bering Sea side of the peninsula, right across from Coal Bay, which is deep water, Pacific, Eisenbeck, shallow water, Bering Sea. And the assumption was that those shallow eelgrass lagoon fishes must have some way of adapting to temperatures that would actually be below the freezing point of their flesh. And so that was an interesting location, an interesting study. The other early in my career piece of research had to do with coral reef fishes out at Eniwetok in the Marshall Islands. One of my graduate students, even though he came here and studied these Alaskan fishes with me, kept saying, "You know, I really want to study coral reef fishes." I said, all right, Al, I'm going to write this proposal to look at parrot fishes on coral reefs. There was a marine biology laboratory at Eniwetok funded by the Atomic Energy Commission. They would entertain small grants for travel expense and a little bit of supplies to go out there. So I wrote the proposal, got the grant funded. We went out there and studied parrot fish and how they deal with coral rubble, with dead coral. There is this misconception spawned by Jacques Cousteau that parrotfishes go around smashing their heads into coral, living coral, to bust off hunks that they can then gobble up and digest. And of course, he had a particular parrotfish in mind, totally erroneous. Anybody that observes parrotfish in the field, you never see them actually eating living coral, and they are not so clumsy as to bump into these very sharp objects.
Yeah.
So parrot fishes rasp the algae off of dead coral, and sometimes rasp off the dead coral itself, because things bore into the dead coral, and those things could be sponges, could be little clams, could be algae, all have nutritional value. And of course, parrot fishes are these really cool fish that have beaks like parrots that are all fused teeth, and they rasp this dead coral, run it through their GI tracts, and extract the nutrients from what they grind up. They have some teeth, some pharyngeal teeth that work like the Indian grinding stones I'd seen in the American Southwest with the matat and the mono.
Mm-hmm.
So here are these teeth grinding this coral into paste, putting it through their GI tracts. And of course, the upshot is, from a radiological standpoint, these fishes process coral that may have taken up radioisotopes, and that coral can then be transformed, moved through the ecosystem. And of course, the Atomic Energy Commission was at least paying lip service to wanting to know where all these radionuclides they'd created
were going. Yeah.
And I think it was kind of an afterthought. They blew up the atom and hydrogen bombs out there and said, "You know, maybe we ought to know where this stuff goes." A lot of their early experiments indicate that they were totally clueless about where it was going to go.
Yeah. Well, based on the Firecracker Boys.
Exactly.
Yeah. With new genetic analysis tools and computers, so many of the researchers that I've talked to say they broke open the field and really radically transformed it. Is that true for you, Ron, in zoology or marine science?
Certainly those esoteric tools have made a huge impact on the discipline of biology and zoology. Since my work was mostly organismal, it didn't make a huge impact on me, except I occasionally had to relearn the names of fish that had been moved from one genus to another. Case in point, everybody knows there are 5 Pacific salmon in Alaska, except that's not really true. There are 7, and those other 2 used to be called trout.
Huh.
And one is the rainbow trout, also known as steelhead, and the other is cutthroat trout. And the genetic analysis that you probably referring to, the gene sequencing and the relatedness information that those kinds of studies can
reveal,
come up with,
yeah,
showed that both of these 2 species were much more closely related to the Pacific salmon, and so now both those species are in the same genus as Pacific salmon.
This is Northern Soundings. I'm Robert Hannon. If you're just joining us, I'm talking with marine scientist and author Ron Smith. When I get back from the break, communicating a passion for nature. listening to Northern Soundings. I'm Robert Hannon. Broadcast of Northern Soundings is made possible by listeners like you and support from the University of Alaska Fairbanks. A complete list of contributors can be found on the Northern Soundings page at the KUAC website. This episode, I'm talking with Ron Smith, who, besides marine science, can teach on other key aspects of biology. Let's get back to our chat.
Let's get you to the classroom, because you list this on your CV, some 17 different subjects, everything from ichthyology to introductory biology, natural history of Alaska. That's an incredibly wide range. As a scientist, do you have a through line on how you engage students at that introductory phase to get them through the more narrow disciplines or examinations?
Well, I think at every course, at every level, whether it's introductory, intermediate, or pretty advanced stuff, and I taught a couple of graduate courses as well, I think there are some fundamentals in each of these subject areas that it is imperative to address. You know, Jerry and I talked about this a lot in terms of introductory biology, and Dale and I talked about this. Dale Guthrie taught mammalogy, and I taught ichthyology, and those are, you know, the 400 level, senior level courses, and what do we really need the students to know, and how do we get that delivered? And so in introductory biology, you can't possibly get it all in one semester because there's just too much to know.
Mm-hmm.
And so how do you eat an elephant? Bite at a time.
Bite at a time.
And so you've got to decide what the bites are at the introductory level. Of course, the Department of Biology here was incessantly arguing about which should come first. Should we talk about the big picture, you know, the evolutionary, you know, ecosystem, communities, species, you know, organismal biology, and then get down to the, finally you're getting down to unwinding the strands of DNA.
The details, yeah.
Or do you do it the other way? Do you start winding the strands of DNA and end up with evolution on the coming out the other end? And of course, these arguments would occur because each of the biologists was coming at this question from a different place.
Sure.
And so the organismal, ecological type guys were saying, well, we ought to start with the big picture because that's what attracted us to biology.
Mm-hmm.
That's why I had the career I had. I was interested in whole animals to whole plants, systems, not chemicals in a test tube. But on the other hand, geneticists, they're all about stuff in a test tube. So then it becomes a matter of what is the crucial, essential bits of information that students need to carry away. It's easier to identify in some courses than in others, perhaps.
Uh-huh.
So the whole introductory sequence in biology is, there's a lot of stuff there.
Yeah, there sure is.
Human anatomy and physiology. It's learning probably a 6,000 word vocabulary, new language, in two semesters.
Right.
And learn it as if somebody's life depends on it, because it actually does. Somebody's life will depend on what you as a nursing student or you as a pre-med takes away from human anatomy and physiology.
Sure.
If you get that wrong, it's important.
Right. Yeah. But, you know, I've talked to a lot of researchers, and there are some who just adore being out in the field and really don't like the classroom. But you seem equally comfortable communicating your love of science as well as practicing science. Where did you get that from, Ron?
I'd like to say both my folks were teachers and I must have picked it up there. But, you know, I recall in middle school and high school saying, boy, I will never be a teacher. Because you guys are always coming home and unloading all the day's woes. You know, oh my gosh. It's like, you know, taking the cap off the pressure cooker, you know. Instead, after 3.5 years in college studying biology, I realized, you know, all my senior classmates, they had their, boy, they knew where they were going. I'm going to apply to these medical schools. I'm going to be in this place. I'm going to do that. And I'm sitting there thinking, wow, I only had 4 years of biology. And I wanted to learn more. That drove me to apply to graduate school. That drove me to complete a master's and then a PhD. because I was continually wanting to learn more. And when I got here, I was in an atmosphere where my colleagues all wanted to learn more about their discipline. And I did too. And I love that.
So, you know, so many people I know who are scientists talk about those, the sort of early days at UAF where there was extraordinary collegiality. Was that your experience too, that you could go to somebody and kind of talk through some of this stuff? Okay, maybe not. We'll pass on then.
Well, no, the question of collegiality is a really good question as it applies to the University of Alaska Fairbanks when I arrived here. Because in a very real sense, the university system when I arrived here was a totalitarian state. And the definition of totalitarianism is rule from the top with punishment and fear of punishment as means of exacting what was supposed to happen. That was, let's see, 68 was still within William R. Wood's reign as president of the university. And one thing the faculty, Jerry and Dale and others, informed me or instilled in me was, you got to be careful because the president can reach down to the departmental level and
summarily,
yeah,
just kind of
like Spider Woman sitting on top of Spider Rock. The misbehaving children, she'll send down a web and snatch them up and eat them. And of course, the examples that were given to me were all the Project Chariot faculty that were
Pruitt and Viereck and
That were not only fired but blackballed. Their careers were ruined by the system. And so I felt a great deal of collegiality within the area I was in, but the administration took active measures to keep us from interacting with other. We had to do it on our own. There was no faculty club. There was, you know, faculty governance was virtually non-existent. We could make proposals or make suggestions, but I feel that, you know, if they happened to align with the stars, fine, but if they didn't, tough luck.
Mm-hmm.
So I did go out of my way to try to find other faculty in other areas and learn what they were doing. I took a photography course from Jimmy Bedford.
Oh yeah.
Which was a hoot. I took a human biology course from Richard Scott in the anthropology department and met regularly with a couple of the anthropologists, with, you know, Dale and Richard Scott and Roger Powers, and I would get together for a bag lunch, which we eventually called the red bag lunch because Roger somehow would always turn the conversation to the Soviet Union. So it's a red bag lunch. He's going to talk about the Reds. And I took a printmaking class from Todd Sherman in the art department and sang in Janelle Soler's university chorus a couple of times with my wife, Marcia. And so life back in the William R. Wood era was interesting and, you know, tense.
Let's shift then to happier topics, because you've written, obviously, extensively for your peers in the sciences, but you've also written for the general public. You have three popular books out, and I wondered, were there abilities or things that you picked up writing scientifically that you could apply to these other books, or did you have to learn a whole new way of communicating?
Choice B.
Yeah.
You cannot communicate with the general public through the strict scientific writing format. Scientific writing is stereotyped. That is, it's always formatted in exactly the same way. It's almost telegraphic in style. There are no extra words.
No dialogue or...
There's no speculation, no dialogue for sure.
Yeah.
If you speculate, the reviewers rip you to shreds. You have to base your conclusions on findings that, if not proven, because nothing is ever really proven in science,
sure,
pretty darn substantial. And of course, other scientists can always argue about your evidence, but you don't go very far out of your way to speculate in a scientific paper. So it's, here's the abstract, introduction, materials and methods, results, conclusions, and you do not vary from that format.
So why did you want to branch out?
Well, if I tried to, let's say I took one of those papers in my CV and tried to deliver that to my ichthyology students, I would hear the loud snoring of the students that fell asleep. It doesn't work in communication with people that are trying to learn at a more basic level. So you have to find a way to engage the students or the audience. And one of my ways is to tell stories. If you can tell in the process of talking about the relatives of flying fishes, if you can tell about 6 foot long javelin like fish skipping across the sea surface impaling human beings.
That you got my attention.
That's right. Yeah, you would never forget houndfish.
No, you sure would not.
And so you tell these stories. Well, there were these fishermen out in a boat in the Gulf of Mexico, and they were trying to catch flying fish to use for bait. And so they're in their boat, they put up a white sheet, shine a light on it, and the flying fish come skipping in, they're blinded by the light, they sail into the sheet, boom, down on the net, that's your bait. Until the houndfish comes skipping in and impales the fisherman.
Yeah.
So people remember that. And then
you wouldn't forget that too quickly, would you?
Yeah. And then students will ask, okay, so why do fish jump out of the water? And of course, my stand-up answer, the first answer is, they jump out of the water to have an out-of-body-of-water experience. and then when they quit laughing, so then we can talk about, okay, why do fish jump out of the water?
Yep.
So it starts with a story for me.
This is Northern Soundings, and I'm talking with zoologist and author Ron Smith. When we get back from the break, what to include when writing about natural history. This is Northern Soundings. This summer I aired recorded discussions I hosted as part of a UAF Summer Sessions event called Down Memory Lane. This week I'm speaking with zoologist and author Ron Smith. Let's get back to the discussion.
I'm going to get to the story on how not to die hunting in a minute. But in your natural history of interior and northern Alaska, that's a huge amount of information. How did you approach that? And what did you decide to include, and what did you decide not to? I mean, impaling fish, definitely go in. I don't care where, I'm kidding.
Well, unfortunately, it didn't fit.
Yeah,
so
that's right.
I had to throw that one away. I had to throw that one back. Well, I guess we start with the impetus for writing the book at all. And I traded off teaching natural history of Alaska with Doug Schammel, one of my colleagues from early on, now departed. And he and I, and everybody that had taught it up to that point, rued the fact that there was no single source of information that would tell students most of what they needed to know about the plants, animals, landscapes of Alaska. And so it was always a cobbled together thing of some readings out of the Wildlife Notebook series that Fish and Game puts out, and some chapters out of a book here, and a scientific paper here that was pretty informative. And so when I, of course, you know, when you're teaching three or four courses a year or five, you don't have a lot of extra time to like sit down and I think I'll write a book. And so when I retired, I thought, you know, now I do have the time. Mm. And I could put down what I already know. And even better than that, when I run into what I don't know, I can find out about that too. Mm-hmm. And so there are some areas in that book where you're reading about mycorrhizas in the boreal forest and lichens in the boreal forest. And when you finished reading what I wrote, you may have my sum total knowledge of that subject, because I stopped to learn that stuff to include it, because each of those topics was so either so important or so interesting that it had to be included.
Right.
And so the process of writing that book was very much the same process that led me to take my advanced degrees, come here and teach a variety of different courses, because I wanted to keep learning new stuff.
Yeah. Well, it comes through in the book. Well, finally, on your list of volumes, I have to, How Not to Die Hunting has some great stories, you know, wind and tents and sleeping under trees, and share some of your favorite stories that went into that book and why you got an illustrator to work on that.
When I wasn't writing lecture notes, grading exams, writing tests, or getting ready to do those things in the early years here, I had the great fortune of having an outdoor companion in Dale Guthrie. And we would go on these flying weekend trips. Sometimes we would have a vehicle packed, and somebody had a class that ended at 3 o'clock Friday afternoon, and we jumped in the truck and went to get out and see the great outdoors.
Sure.
To have an adventure, go camping, go hunting. And I have to say that over most of our years here in Alaska, I've subsisted on wild game meat. When I eat cow meat, it kind of makes me sick. Mm. So one of the initial thrusts. I love the outdoors. I loved hunting. It was actually an economical way, a way to help stretch the budget. And what we were paid here as faculty in the early years was, well, I looked it up, and when I got here in 1968, my salary was less than a truck driver with a brand new CDL, commercial driving license. I made less money than a long-haul truck driver. Parenthetically, when I retired with 31 years of instruction, of effort, and still with those three degrees, I still made less money than a long-haul truck driver with 31 years experience. So that tells you right away that the scientists in this room, the academicians in this room, and scholars in this room did not get into this for the money. And I remember a conversation I had with Bryna Kessel. She said, so how's it going? This was in the first year. I said, well, the work is enjoyable. It's I it's taxing me intellectually, and that's great, but we're struggling financially. And she said, oh, I thought we were well paid here. Of course, she was independently wealthy and had married a very wealthy man.
He was a long-haul driver, by the way.
Yeah. Yeah. Who knew stuff?
Yeah, knew stuff.
And it was an interesting situation because a lot of the faculty were in the same boat, and we began to help each other build cabins. So I would go out to Dale's place, we would put up the walls of a cabin, and then John Fox over in forestry, I want to start this cabin. Hey, bring the crew, get the word out. And so, so hunting was actually fit into a low budget existence.
Lifestyle, right. Yeah.
Yeah.
And must have been a stress buster too.
In
Except
a way.
When you were frozen to the ground or
you had to bring that up. Okay, yeah. So one of the other colleagues was a geneticist named Russ Shoemaker. He came up from Arizona, which was he had a whole lot more difficulty transitioning from Arizona to Alaska than I did from Florida to Alaska. So I remember one winter camping hunting trip that Dale and Russ and I were on, where Russ had his parka on inside his sleeping bag, and he couldn't get the sleeping bag unzipped because, of course, he was wearing his mittens. I think we might have called him a sissy, but I don't know. Anyway, yeah, there were great times. Interesting observations of wild animals and circumstances, mistakes. Anyway, back to Russ. He and I went up one early October up to Murphy Dome and spotted these two moose way off the road and did a really dumb thing. We went down there and shot them both. and then did another even dumber thing, and that was to walk out the wrong way. And we thought we didn't want to go straight up back up to Murphy Dome out of the bottom of the creek there and tried to go for that. Anyway, we took the long way out and were so exhausted when we got back to the road that I said, Russ, I just got to lay down for a minute. And of course, one of the chapters in my book is try not to sweat. Well, we obviously sweated on this one. And when I laid down in the road, my coat froze to the road. And I didn't have, even with my mittens off, I couldn't get the zipper off. So I just had to try to do these sit-ups until I ripped the back of the coat clear off, and it was still frozen to the road. So that left Jeannie Armstrong, my illustrator, with a great opportunity to draw.
And she, you could tell she relished it.
Yeah, her favorite was the illustration she used for the first chapter of the book. The first chapter is Think About Water. If you cross streams on a wilderness hike, be aware that if it rains or if it's really hot and the snow melt upriver gets significant, stream levels can rise. Mm-hmm. And so we've crossed streams that then became impossible to cross on the way back, or in general, crossing streams. If you cross a stream that's waist deep or knee deep, if you have your pants on, they're wet. And then they're wet for the rest of the time. They're wet. And that can be very uncomfortable. So one way to avoid that problem is to take your pants off. And I guess I just didn't explain to Jeannie that you don't take everything off. Because this first drawing is the rear view of a camper or a hiker in a backpack and no pants on. And I stress that you put your boots back on because you can't afford to have your feet roll over on those
rocks.
Yeah. And if your feet get numb.
Right.
So she draws this picture of this guy with a, you know, naked from the waist down, except for the boots, of course.
It was memorable.
I said, "Jeannie, can you make my buns look this good?" And she said, "I'm an artist, not a magician."
Well, I want to take this opportunity to thank you, Ron Smith, for sharing some of those stories.
Well, thanks for having me, and thanks for coming. Thanks.
That's it for this Northern Soundings. I'm your host, Robert Hannon. I want to thank Ron Smith and Summer Sessions for permission to air this discussion and the entire series. Links to Ron's work can be found on the Northern Soundings website. I'm returning to my regular schedule, and next week at this time, you'll be able to hear the Fairbanks School Board meeting. I'll see you again in 2 weeks. Thanks for listening.